Okay, good morning. So, to start things off, there's been some discussion online about times of the midterm. It's like, sorry, I can't move the midterm regularly as I said. I think that would be unfair to many of you who have kind of built your schedules around this. And it just, I know I've done this before. I've tried moving things, and it just leads to incredible amounts of chaos. So I can't move it. I think it's only fair. I don't feel good about trying to offer an alternate seating after the main one, because basically then I'm giving an advantage to whoever does that. So that's why I have the earlier time. So hopefully that works. If it doesn't, I'm sorry. And the main thing to know is that if you blow the midterm, you have a chance to make up for it on the final. As I said earlier, I normally do a grading scheme where I count the final for the midterm grade. So if you do better on the final rather than the midterm, your final will count 60% of your grade. If you do otherwise, it'll count the normal 35%. So if you learn the stuff, you learn the stuff, and you know you get the grade for that. So, but it's always better if you don't want to count on that. So do your best, but what I'm just saying is if you blow it, it's not the end of the world. So that's first off. Second of all, I think some people were having questions about the assignment. So what are the issues you're having with assignment 5? So, did you all look up what?
Yep. It showed 4 pointers. Looking it up, 4 pointers at different information. That's all over here. But
So here's a key question. How do I expect you to go about solving these sort of problems? I do not expect you to just look it up. I expect you to think about it. And in fact, what I crafted there is a question that does not lend itself to Google search directly. You have to interpret it. It's actually a very simple question. It's actually almost a little bit of a trick question, how simple it is. But it's only simple if you understand what we've been talking about in terms of virtual address, virtual addresses versus physical addresses, the relative size of those address spaces. If you look up PAE, all PAE is a way for a system that has a normal, a system with a 32-bit processor to have more than 4 gigs of RAM. I said a 32-bit processor with more than 4 gigs of RAM. So you just say 32-bit, more than 4 gigs of RAM. 32-bit means at most 4 gigs of, most the 4 gigs addressing. So what does that actually mean? What is that referring to? Where, how do we get more than 32 bits on a 32-bit processor? Where does that fit in? If you look it up, you'll see the physical address space is more than 32 bits. Have other things changed about it? I'll just say that. Go and think about it. It's actually a very simple question, not a hard question. If you look up what PAE is, and you look at the size, what they're talking about and what they're specifically not talking about. No, PAE is not for 64-bit processors. If I tell you much more, I'll just give you the answer. I'm going to try not to just give you the answer, but if you're still stuck next week, ask me Wednesday, and maybe I'll be a little more of a hint. But just, yeah. What's very important is to be able to apply the knowledge that you learn. If you learn things in this class and then you leave this class and you can't connect what you hear about in the press and other things, or reading technical documentation to what you learned in this class, I failed. You've got to, the stuff you learn here is just so basic to so much of what you'll see out there with people talking about computer systems. It shows up in all, in every, any review you see of a new computer or a new operating system. They'll talk about things we're talking about here. So you should be able to connect what we talk about here to that. I'll give you one last hint. What software do processors with a PAE extension run? Last hint. Any other questions? So the other ones, again, the other ones, they're, so questions 1, 2, and 3 are just more checking to see how your conceptual model is. If they're hard, that means you haven't completely understood there's something about how the basic idea of paging and segmentation and stuff, those are still fuzzy in your head. When you have those crystal in your head, they'll be like, oh, yeah, of course. I mean, there's nothing to work out. There's barely anything to look up, maybe for a few definitions. Question 4, where I ask this, has virtual address and physical address. That's looking at the thing I did at the beginning of last lecture, with looking at the number of bits in the virtual and physical address. The main thing to remember is page sizes are always powers of 2. Why are they powers of 2? Is because they're about splitting the address along at a bit boundary. You can't do the split if it's not bit aligned, so it has to be a power of 2. If that seems mysterious, what I said, play with binary notation a little bit and hexadecimal notation. Write it out. Use some online converters. Question? Yes?
So question number 3 is, something really super sneaky about 2 registers momentarily holding the same address when the process is being started or something like that.
I think more to the point is you should think about when might you want segments to overlap. And in particular, you've seen how these registers are used. Things like you have the basic code segment register, the base segment register, the stack segment register. Is there a time when you might want these things to overlap? Or is there a time when you say they really should not overlap? Or is there any mechanism there to maybe you just say, well, there's no mechanism to prevent it? Or maybe there is a mechanism to prevent it. That's just what I want you to say there. Number 5. That you should look up, and you should have also seen that in doing the tutorial work, the exchange instruction. 6, we've talked about Peterson's algorithm, and then spin locks, we talked about that, why we might want to use spin locks even though they're expensive. We talked about that in lecture. And then 8, 8's a little exercise in seeing if you understand. It's actually kind of a funny thing. Instead of adding locking to a program, you're removing locking. But you still want it to be correct. So you think a bit about it, it's a little bit of a puzzle, but it's not a very big puzzle. Okay, it's a pretty simple program. So I did not design this assignment as something that was supposed to be very tough. But it is something that's supposed to test your understanding of all these concepts. And that is a bit tough in terms of there's a lot of pieces to fit together. Okay, other questions, hints?
Also, let me make sure I check one thing here. So we are talking to so. So the big thing I have to talk about today is the deadlock. How many of you are familiar with the term deadlock? Okay, so it's one of those things that come up always in an operating system class. It's something you should know about when you think about concurrency problems. It's also one of these problems that it's led to a lot of theory papers, CS theory papers, where people have studied solutions for deadlock, which in practice have turned out to be mostly useless. So some operating system textbooks spend a lot of time talking about deadlock because, well, there's a lot of papers you discuss and a lot of solutions. But if you're talking about operating systems rather than algorithms that have come up in the context of studying operating systems, sort of, better not spend too much time on deadlock. But before I talk about deadlock, I have to talk about a restaurant. So this is the dining philosopher's problem. How many of you heard of that? From the textbook? So the dining philosopher's problem. So let's assume we have a bunch of philosophers going to, or mathematicians, going to a Chinese restaurant. Instead of going to this Chinese restaurant, they're at this table, they sit there and they have their plates. Say they got five of them here. And got all these people here sitting there. They're discussing deep thoughts. Really deep thoughts. They're busy discussing away. So much to the point they're not really paying that much attention to it. Now, this restaurant, this Chinese restaurant, is a bit stingy with giving out the chopsticks. And what they've only done is they've given out five chopsticks. There's one between all of them. Now, if you've ever tried eating anything with chopsticks, with one chopstick, you realize this is a problem. You're not getting very far with one chopstick. You need two. So the dining philosopher's problem comes down to how do we make it? How do we design an algorithm that does not require these people to coordinate? Because they're busy talking important things. They're not communicating about sharing chocolates. How do you design an algorithm so that everyone will get two chopsticks when they're hungry, when they want to eat. And you won't get into a situation where no one eats. Because there's certain pathological states that you can get into. For example, what happens if everyone says, grab right chopstick, grab. Let's just do a simple algorithm. Then, why is this a bad solution? Exactly. Everyone goes, grabs their right chopstick. They have one right chopstick in their hand. And they go to grab their left chopstick, and there is no chopstick there because the person to their right took it. Now they're sitting there with the chopstick in their hand. How do I put anything of like hold on to the chopstick for a while and then put it down if you can't get the left chopstick? No. I just said grab the right chopstick, grab the left chopstick, go.
Is it an atomic operation grabbing both the chopsticks?
No, they're two separate resources. This is the issue, why you want atomic resources. If there's some way of saying, I can make sure I grab both chopsticks at exactly the same time, you might not have this problem. But is that, no, if two people are scrambling for the chopstick, you know, someone's going to grab it. You can't guarantee to win the race for the chopstick.
You should do something better.
But now remember, these folks are busy talking. You can't like say, hey, could you put down your chopstick? I'm older. Put it down. Or something. I'm stronger. Put it down. You took it last time. Put it down. No, there's no coordination. This is actually kind of a silly problem if you're talking about real people. You can't think of these as real people, but real people would never have this kind of problem. They would figure out some way of around it.
No, if a rotation implies that everyone takes turns, but now you've serialized the entire process of eating, everyone has to coordinate.
Yeah. So this is kind of... So this is not a good solution. Now, what's one way to solve this? Well, let's look at ways that you could have things like randomize. If you randomize when you go for the chopsticks,
and you randomize how long you wait between times you take bites, does that eliminate the problem? No. The problem is still there. You've just made it less likely. That doesn't really solve it.
Yes?
The idea of the diet philosopher's problem is to solve it with these resources, not to change the problem. Yeah, if you change the problem, like, you can increase the number of resources. If you're adding another chopstick, it's not a problem. Yep. Well, the trouble is if you add in a waiter or something, then now you have this problem of, oh, so what you could have is a waiter
come along and whack everyone in the head if they're sitting there with their one chopstick in. Computer product as a watchdog. The system locks up. So, yes. That's a classic situation. So I was letting it finish here. So you say a timeout. That means you hold it for 10 seconds, and if you haven't gotten the other one, you put it down.
Now, that by itself leads to another funny situation.
Where you have them all picking up their chopsticks, and they're all putting it back down. They're all picking up their chopsticks, and they're all putting it back down. Well, if you combine the two, then yeah, now you think, but I'm saying just a timeout doesn't necessarily solve it, because you could have these synchronized timeouts.
Randomization does help, but it doesn't get rid of the problem, it just makes it less likely.
Well, let's try. This is a weird one. You can order the resources. Now, here we said grab right, grab left. What if we, instead of saying grab right, grab left, grab lowest, and then grab next highest? So now let's call this A, B, C, D, E. now you grab, so this one grabs, you know, grabs A, then grabs B. This one grabs B, then grabs C. This one grabs C, this grabs D, then grabs D. D, then E. So same as before, except for this guy. Instead of grabbing, right yet. Okay, you do left, then right, left, then right, left, then right. And so here, this guy's going to grab right, then left. So what's going to happen is we break the circularity, because now this guy here is going to get D and E. But this one's going to go for A. It won't find A, because this one's going to get here. And then these two will go for A at the same time. One of them will get it, or the other one won't get it. And then these folks, if this one gets it, then these two have one in their hand, but these folks have complete sets. So they'll eat, finish, put them down, and then they'll get the resources necessary for them to continue.
The circular pattern of this is key to the deadlock. So the situation where you have everyone sitting there with a resource held, but not having enough resources to actually make progress, is called deadlock.
When you have the timeouts, where they're just going, trying, not trying, trying, not trying, that's called live lock. Deadlock, you're not doing anything. You're stuck completely. Live lock, you're actually doing something, but it's a useless something. Not making progress. Yes?
What you just said, you said two guys only have one each, and that's a full set. Two at one point, you have a full set.
Let's do this. So what you would have is, wait, this guy would get, so these two are both going for one. One of them would win one. These two, B then C. Actually, you're right. I think only one of them gets it.
Yeah,
five. Yeah, you're right. Only one of them gets it. You're right. Only this guy gets it. He gets it. But that's all you need for progress, is one of them B. Thank you.
So why is this an interesting problem? Hopefully you can see why this problem is interesting from analytical point of view. It's a nice, simple little construct. And you can start thinking about all kinds of different algorithms for the individual parties to run. And you can think of all kinds of analyses you can do. How does this apply to operating systems? Not quite. So sharing resources between threads, yes, by a little more. It's analogy, yeah, exactly, for synchronization concurrency. The whole idea is these are, instead of chopsticks, you should think of these as locks.
And if you think of these as, say, A, B, C, D, and E are different data structures.
What this is saying is, you know, it's one thing to say I need one data structure to make progress, but what if I have to manipulate two data structures? Because let's say I'm copying things between two lists. I'm removing an item from one list, and then I'm putting it onto another list. So a natural thing to do is to want exclusive access to both those lists so that I can move an item from one to the other. But what happens if I grab the lock, from list A to list B? If I grab the lock on list A, and then grab the lock on list B, while another thread or something grabs the lock on list B, and then tries to grab the lock on list A, both of us will have one lock. Neither of us will have the other. Neither of us will ever give it up if we hold onto the lock forever, and we're both stuck. We're sitting there with our chopsticks in our hand, not making any progress.
So what this says is this is a basic problem you have any time you do locking, is that you can't expect to get
all the resources at once. That's the whole point of locking. You're basically asking for your turn. But if you don't do things right, when you ask for that resource, you may get into a situation where you have some of them and not all of them. And if someone else is waiting on a different set of, on the same resources but in a different order, you collide in the sense of you now both are stuck. No one's making any progress unless something happens. Okay. How can that ever happen in your computer system? Well, whenever you've had your system lock up where it seems to be alive, but it's not doing anything, there's a very possible chance that this sort of thing is what has happened. That somehow some sort of concurrency bug has hit you, so that someone grabbed certain locks and never got them. Tried to grab some locks and never got them because someone else had them, and now you're stuck. So this does happen in systems. It doesn't happen that often, but when you start programming concurrently, you will encounter deadlock bugs where your entire system just locks up.
So, well, actually, I think that
the crosses here I'm saying is these are not perfect solutions. In practice, you do use randomization, you do use timeouts. Ideally, ordering resources solves the problem. If you always grab locks in a certain order, then you're okay. But in practice, it's hard to make sure you always do things in the right order because now you might have, say, millions of lines of code. And how do you make sure everyone's asking for the resources in exactly the right order? Have programming conventions. You can try to have some things, but it's not so easy. So real systems do things like have they have timeouts on the locks. Like you can only hold the lock for so long before it's automatically released. Or you have some randomization how you do things. Or you have things like
a watchdog,
which watches for now, there's a little terminology I want. I always have to check this whenever I'm. So, deadlock bugs. Okay. All right. So, first, let's talk about the conditions. When can you have deadlock? Four conditions have to apply. One is mutual exclusion. So you've got to be doing something like locks, critical sections. Another is hold and wait, which means that you can grab a lock and then wait for the next one. So you've got to be able to spin or go to sleep or something. You don't just do things of try the lock. If the lock's not there, then you continue with the computation. No. No preemption. So what is preemption in this case?
Turn on the diet philosophy problem. What is preemption?
No, preemption is punching your buddy and grabbing his chopstick. It's taking the resource by force or by authority or whatever, but it's saying, you have it,
no, you can't have it. It's mine.
So you can only have deadlock if everyone's too polite. As I was saying, in practice, people are never that polite, so they're going to start. Once people actually get hungry enough, they're not going to be so polite. They'll start grabbing chopsticks. And the last condition is circular weight. That's why this dining philosophy problem people like the circular table. You make this into a long table, problem goes away. Because you got to have something that A is weighing.
What?
This guy's weighing on this one, this one's 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 weighing on this one. That's what gets us into this problem. You break any of these, you can't have deadlock. So when people talk about deadlock, they talk about strategies for avoiding it, strategies for removing the problem. So in terms of these strategies, what's one of them? One is prevention. When you want to prevent deadlock, you want to construct your system so that deadlock can never happen.
Make it impossible.
Now, how do you make it impossible? It's pretty simple. Make sure these four conditions never all apply. Design your system such that one of these or more go away. So if you could say, make all of your locks preemptible. So if someone really needs a lock, they can steal it away from someone else. You can build systems like that. People have built them like this.
Make it so you never wait for a lock. Lots of different ways to design these systems.
In practice, you don't do this too much. You try to do as much to minimize the possibility of it, but you don't prevent them completely. Mm-hmm. Well, let's say, for example, you have one thread that has, let's say it wants three locks to continue. Let's say it's gotten one and then has gone to sleep. So let's say whenever someone's gone, gets a lock and then goes to sleep, you can steal away their lock, so long as you give it back to them before you wake them up. So they fell asleep, I'll take their chopstick, give it back to them before they wake up, they'll never know the difference. Then there's this notion of avoidance. Terminology in the deadlock literature gets really annoying. And you'll see that these words are like, what's the difference between these? It's not that bad. Prevention means you're making it impossible for this to happen. Avoidance means you still, all four conditions are there in principle. But you can watch the unfolding of the computation. And notice when you're getting into a situation that could lead to deadlock. And then you say, I'm not going to give you that lock right now. Because if I did, I might end up eventually in a state of deadlock. So I'm going to hold off.
Yeah.
Well, it's looking ahead, yes. It's not necessarily prediction.
Prediction is one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is just allocating resources such that you know that it's never going to happen. So it's not necessarily prediction where you just let everyone do things. You may actually be laying a schedule for how everyone operates so that you can plan out that that's never going to happen.
Make, like, for example, let's say we're talking about car accidents. Complete prevention, never get in a car. Can't have a car accident. Not in your car. Right? Avoidance is you see yourself coming towards something and you steer away. Right? Don't run into that tree. Steer around it. Notice the tree is coming. Or you have strategies like stay within the lane. Don't go off the road.
So when people talk about avoidance, they get into it. So, yeah, did they directly talk about this? Yeah. No, they don't. Oh, that's great. I love this textbook. Because there are these algorithms for doing deadlock avoidance. I think like the Bankster's algorithm that might be mentioned in there. And yeah, no one ever uses it. So why bother covering it? So makes me happy. And then the third,
prevention, don't get in the car. Avoidance, have traffic rules and other strategies for making sure you don't have an accident. Protect and recover, you had an accident. Sorry. Call the police, call the body shop, fix it up. In practice, we mostly do detect and recover. You kind of try to do a bit of this, but it's...
You don't do all of it perfectly, but you have something. Detect and recover. Okay, wow, we're not making any progress on that. That's where things like watchdog timers come in. You say that. So, does anyone know what a watchdog timer is? Sorry, I just realized I'm racist. So a watchdog timer is something that just watches a system and then. So probably the easiest way to think of this is, an easy way of doing this is you. Let's say you have to call in to see if a guard is going around. You know they're supposed to signal in and when a guard is checking the perimeter and they're supposed to call, you know, check in periodically with the home base saying, "Oh yes, I'm here. Yes, everything's fine." They're supposed to let you know that's fine. So if someone wants to attack the base, what are they going to do? They're going to take out the guard. When they take out the guard, then the signal that, you know, the signal isn't going to come in. You know, something bad has happened to that guard. And you take steps, deal with it. So similarly with the watchdog timer, it's normally a little mechanism, a circuit or a separate processor that's watching the main processor, and it's periodically sending it messages. And it's expecting to get back a response. These are normal interrupts, typically, to the system. So if the operating system is working properly and responding to interrupts, it will keep sending messages back to the watchdog timer and saying, OK, yes, I'm alive. Yes, I'm alive. But if you don't respond to the watchdog timer's request, the watchdog timer goes, uh-oh, and it restarts the system. Watchdog timers is how systems can spontaneously reboot, not because they've had other problems, but spontaneously reboot in order to make sure that the system stays functioning. Because otherwise, you know, the system can lock up, and then, okay, you're offline. But the watchdog timer knows, hey, something bad's happened, you reboot the system, now you're back. The assumption being that when you reboot, you reinitialized everything, and you should be safe. Can you end up back in that lock state again? Yes. But watchdog timers are designed under the assumption that this isn't going to happen often. If your watchdog timer trips often, the system is pathologically broken. So that's your detect and recover. Get a car accident. Let's go to the hospital. Seem okay? So again, not the most exciting subject. I really don't want to discuss much more about deadlock in this class. It's more, I just, frankly, I could probably ask you many questions on the midterm or final about deadlock if I wanted to, but I really don't. So I'm not. And you'll notice that this wasn't in the assignment or anything, but okay, I might put one question in there some point, but it won't be very serious. So you should look at it. You should get a basic idea about it, but don't worry about it too much. And we are at 9:16, so I'm going to pause, and we'll come back at 9:21.
Okay, let's start strong again here. So if you look in the textbook, there's two other. I've been talking about stuff from the concurrency bugs, concurrency problems chapter.
Two classes of non-deadlock type bugs they talk about. Atomicity violations and order violations.
These are
non-deadlock concurrency bugs.
So we taught non-deadlock concurrency bugs.
These are actually pretty simple ideas. Atomicity violations, all we're talking about is,
oh, you were supposed to lock it and you didn't. You had a section that was supposedly mutually exclusive and it wasn't. You were supposed to grab the lock and you didn't. Oops.
That's a pretty straightforward thing. Order violation is a little funnier.
So when you talk about serial computation, you talk about, okay, you know, the program starts, and you have this happen, you have this happen, and this happen, and then it finishes. With concurrent computation, things are happening in different orders. You have different threads and parts of doing things at the same time. So when you have this ordering, the order now is potentially highly variable.
So you can have things where you actually attempt to use something
that hasn't been initialized. You assume an order, or basically you get out of order in your computation, is what the order thing says. The most common way you get out of order is use before
so you might have one thread that's assuming it can use, say, a device,
and the other one which is supposed to be initializing the device, and if you try using the device before you initialize it, or use the data structure before you initialize it, bad things happen. Makes sense. So you shouldn't see any sort of,
this is, I didn't use my locks right, and I didn't use my condition variables right. Ordering, how do you ensure ordering? You have condition variables. How do you ensure atomicity? Use mutual exclusion. These errors saying, I didn't use it right. Didn't use that one right. That's all.
Now, before I leave concurrency and go on and talk about other more fun things, there is one topic I have to talk about because I'm a security guy. These things come up.
And that is TalkTal. You go, I'm like, what? What's that jumble of letters? Time of check. To time of use.
Time of check to time of use. I'd probably turn it the other way. I mean, easier to read. So this is a kind of, this is what we're talking about, race conditions.
but it's a particular
class of them. And it has to do with what? So in talking about memory accesses to a variable, we're checking when we check the value of the variable and then we try to make a change to it. There's the time when we check it, and there's the time when we actually modify it, when we actually use it.
And the whole point of when we're talking about race conditions is that that can be separated, and that something can happen with the resource in between. We check to see, is the counter zero? Okay, fine. Increment it to one. Oh, someone else incremented it to one before we did. So our check was for stale data. It wasn't when we actually used the resource, it wasn't the same as when we checked it. That's what this thing is basically talking about. So it's in some sense nothing new.
But why it's worth talking about specifically
is because this tends to be a big problem security problem when you're talking about protected resources.
So the classic case is temporary file.
So when I say temporary files, I mean, you have a program running. In the middle of running, it's potentially convenient to dump data to a file, you know, to use it for communication between processes or use it in the data computation or whatever, but you generate temporary files. Where do temporary files go? They often go in a shared directory. Things like
in
or other shared places like school directory or something.
So the idea of a TOPPAL vulnerability when you're talking about temporary files is you check the
shared directory or
so when you run, where this really comes into play is when you run programs that are somehow privileged. This gives me a chance to talk about another thing, which is known as setUID. Historically, they are the ones that have had the most problems with this. So when you are when you normally run a program on a Unix-like system, it runs as you. So you type ls. Ls is running as your program. You are a user. You're the student user. You know, I'm normally a user SOMA in my boxes, but any programs I invoke run as me. Which means they can access any files that I own. They have the privileges that I have. But there are some times when you want to run programs that need more access. Classic kind of thing is so set UID, you also can have set GID. So as I'll explain in a second, but the idea of the password program is what allows you to change your password. Important functionality, right? How is your password stored in the system? It turns out a hash of your password, a secure hash of your password, is stored in a file, slash etc password, and also slash etc slash shadow. It used to be everything was an etc password, but now they split the hashes off into etc shadow for reasons actually relating to the problem I'm talking about here. Anyway, these files
Do you want anyone to have the ability to modify these files? What would happen? You'd be changing other people's passwords. You completely compromise the entire security of the system if you can mess with the password file. But sometimes regular users want to change their password. So I've got this file here that I need to keep protected. I don't want anyone just messing with this. But sometimes I have to allow access to it. I have to allow someone to change it properly. This is not an object-oriented system. These are files. So how do I make sure that only certain code modifies that file?
Well, the old Unix way of doing this was you would have some programs that when they ran, they did not run with the privileges of the person who ran it. They'd run with the privileges of the person who wrote the program, or the person who owns the program. You look at your system and you look at who owns the LS binary. It's root. But when you run ls, does it run as root? No, it runs as you. It's just owned by root because, again, you don't want anyone messing with the ls program. That would be bad for the system. Then who knows what you'd be running when you type ls? So that's our system integrity. You make it owned by the root user. But this password program, I actually want it to run with extra privileges. I want it to run as root. Because I want it to change these special files. If it can't change them, then I have problems. So how do I denote this? It turns out there is a bit in the protection. Just like there's the user, group, other, and then there's that sticky bit, there's also the set UID bit and the set GID bit. There's two of these associated with the owner and the group field. And if these bits are set, then the program runs with either the with the user or the group of the file, of how the file's owned. So the password file, and the password program, bin password, when you run it, it has the set UID bit set, and it's owned by root. So when you run it, it runs as root. Since it runs as root, it can change the password file.
And you hope that it doesn't have bugs. Because if it has bugs, it will corrupt your password file. It's another bad thing. If it's running as root, it could do anything to your system. Limitation of the Unix security model. You set a bit in the permission. In the permissions of the file. Just like you set whether the file is readable, writable, or executable, there's an S bit. So it's actually RWXS. And the S is the set UID bit. It turns out the sticky bit is just the S bit but on the other fields. So there's four bits for each of these things. There's the RWXS for the owner, group, and other. If it's set for the owner, then the program runs as the owner, user. If it's set on the group, it runs with the group privileges of, whatever group it's, the file's own, it's part of that group. If it's on the other, then it's the sticky bit, and then it's, if it's on a file and it's a sticky bit, it doesn't do anything. If it's on a directory, then there's something. So the basic idea you should have here is it's possible to run programs, and when you run them, they don't run as you, they run as another user. So if you are on a multi-user system, for example, and you wanted to have a little game that was in your home directory, and you wanted people to run this game, but you wanted them to change the high score file. But the high score file, you didn't want anyone to be able to change the high score file. It's your game, so you can, of course, change the high score file. But no one else will be able to change it. But you want your game to be able to change it. You might have the game run with, say, your group's privileges or maybe your owner privilege. So you can go in and modify the high score file. No one else can modify it because they're not you, but anyone else can run your game.
Why am I talking about this now?
Because
these sort of programs, these set UID programs, are particularly vulnerable to these tactile vulnerabilities.
Which means that you've got this privileged program, and it will
want to run, you'll want to access a file, and
if you're not careful, it will access the file in a way, it will access the file with the wrong privilege. So,
this password file, this password program, by default, it modifies Etsy password.
But it doesn't only have to modify that file. You would actually use it to modify other files. Let's say you want to set up, why would you want to do this? It's because maybe I want to just generate password hashes for another purpose. Maybe I'm trying to update it as a regular user. There might be some reason that I'm trying to manipulate the password-like file and want to use things. So it has an option for operating on a password file that is not Etsy password. You can specify the password as command. This is dangerous. Because now you're saying,
with what privileges does so bin password runs
with root privileges, because it's set UID root. But it has this command line option that lets it modify any file. So if you're not careful,
you could use this to modify arbitrary files on the system, circumventing system security. Now, of course, people who wrote the password program knew about this. They said, well, we should place some restrictions. So what restrictions do you place on? You have it check the owner and group of the file. And you check the owner and group of the person of the user that invoked the program. So you make sure if user Soma invokes bin password, it will only let me modify files that are owned by me. It won't let me modify arbitrary program. Simple enough. Pretty standard check.
How does it know a file is owned by me?
It has to check. It has to do a system call. It has to do a system call to ask for the inode. We'll be talking about file systems and stuff and how all this works after fall break. But basically, it has to query the file system and find out, well, what's that file? You know, who owns it? And then, it's owned by Soma. Okay, you can go change it. What if I change the file after it's done the check? Or it's modified file. There are these things called symbolic links that you can use.
Did you talk about symbolic links? Did you see that in the tutorial?
I don't think so. We're going to cover that later. But everything in operating systems is connected together. So it gets a bit tricky with how you cover the words. But what you can do is you can do this trick with what's known as a symbolic link. And you could have, you might say, oh, it's just a regular text file that's owned by me. No, change the password file. You know, treat it as a password file, make a change. But then you replace it quickly, and then you have it point to the real password file. Or to something else. And all of a sudden now, I've changed someone else's password. And it's because if I win the race, in between the time it checks and the time it actually modifies the file, if I can get in there, I can do my damage.
And this is a particular problem at the file system level because all the stuff we talked about with locks
isn't quite there for files. You don't, it's much harder to make, there are ways to do locking and things and stuff, but as I'll explain, it's much harder to do these kind of atomic operations on files. So Toctal
is something that happens in memory, but it's more we're talking about things like files, which is a shared resource, which anyone can mess with, and so it's possible to mess with the privileged program and change its view of the world from behind its back.
Now, that was probably too little for you to understand. There's a whole lot more behind that, but I wanted to at least mention it so you had at least heard of it. The basic idea, thing you should know is, if you're programming a system and you're messing with temp files, make sure you use their mechanism for doing secure temporary file allocation when you're doing most programs. One of the ways that you do this is by, it creates a very, very hard to guess file name for your temporary files. If you create a very hard name to guess for your temporary files, then no one else can mess with it because they don't even know the name of it. That's the typical solution. You just make it so that someone can't guess it. A randomization approach. Is it perfect? No. But it protects you generally well enough against these sort of attacks. So if you're programming temporary files, use whatever system mechanism your system provides for doing secure temp files. The only caveat for this is a lot of the built-in routines for doing secure temporary file generation aren't secure. They say they're secure and they're not.
Welcome to my world. Questions? Otherwise, I'm going to move on. We're going to talk more about set UI files when we talk about files. It's not something on the picture. Coming attraction. I need to talk about that in order to explain why. You're going to see this more, just sort of file this away on the concurrency side. That it's not just limited to stuff in memory. Concurrency bugs also happen with file systems. That's probably the high bit of what. So what you have to do is, you know that a privileged program is going to mess with a file. So what you do is, it's doing a check for something. So it's going to do a check, and then it's going to modify the file. So it's just like having a counter in memory where you're checking it, and then you're going to change it. Which you set up your race so that you basically make sure you wait for it to do its check. Once that check is done, you change the resource out from underneath it. And so you basically subvert that check. Whatever it was checking for, make sure it passes that check and then swap it around. You might say, well, how can I win that race? Well, if it's going to happen really fast, well, if I can run other processes of the system, I could potentially do a fork file, for example, and it would really slow the system down, and that could help. I do that correctly or do other kinds of ways of slowing the system down. I can win my race. When one's checking, you have another attack process that's watching it and then switching it once the check happens. So there's the password program. So what happens is the password program is running, it's doing its check. Another program is trying to watch it and then switches out the file from underneath it. So now instead of a user-generated password file, you're now modifying the system password file. But now when I try to modify a user-generated password file, I can change the password of the user. But when I go at the system password file, I can only modify my password. So by tricking it and saying, oh, you're looking at the user password file. Nope, now you're looking at the system password file. I defeat the purpose of the check. And the reason why I can do that is because
the time when I am checking the permissions is different from the time when I'm actually doing the modification. And that's because that's not an atomic operation. I can't check the permission and modify the file at the same time. I can't bind those together so that they all happen at once. There's not the equivalent of a mutex. This actually isn't as much of a problem on Windows machines. Interestingly enough, they have other problems because they actually mostly have all those backup files. Although I haven't heard about these problems with Windows so much. But definitely a problem on Unix.
So I don't expect this to be completely clear. Again, the high bit, the main thing to know about this is that all the things we've talked about happening in memory can also happen in the file system. And the problem with them happening in the file system is that the file system is not specific to each process. It's a shared resource. The only thing that prevents complete sharing is these file permissions, and file permissions are much more coarse-grained. So there's lots of room for messiness. Hanky-panky.
So I just have a couple of minutes left.
And the thing I want you to start thinking about now is I want to switch gears and start thinking about TLVs. TLVs is probably the most annoying term in operating systems, computer architecture, because what it stands for is translation look-aside buffer.
Does that make sense to you? If I turn my head sideways, I can kind of see what it means, but it was due to some IBM engineers who first invented it. Yeah, that's good.
So the purpose of the TLV is this is for dealing with the mappings of virtual to virtual to physical addresses. So when you're going from virtual to physical addresses, you have this thing called the page table. You look them up in the the virtual address in the page table, and then you find the physical address. You do this not on a per address basis, but on a per page frame basis. This is what we talked about earlier.
We'll talk more about the data structure of the page table. It's not actually a table, it's actually a tree with a couple of levels and stuff. And we'll talk about how it's organized. But the important thing to realize is it's a big, complex data structure, and there is no way you can refer to that data structure on every memory access. Because remember, you go from the virtual to physical address on every memory access.
Too slow. So what do you do instead?
Why is it too slow? It's because in order to access a big data structure, you have to access multiple locations of memory. So to resolve one address, I have to look up, say, 3 or 4 memory addresses, and I look in memory and grab data from there. I mean, that you should realize that that does not. The thing you're trying to do quickly, you're requiring having to do many operations that are much slower in order to do this fast operation. Bad.
So the TLB is a cache.
It's a cache of these mappings.
This cache is the smallest cache on the chip. Almost always it's the smallest cache of the chip. The question is, why is it small? It's because it's really weird. Because what's the operation I want to do on this couch?
I want to give it a virtual address. And I want it to give me the corresponding physical address. I want to do a table lookup.
It won't have the entire table in it, but I want to do this quickly. How can you do a really fast table lookup? What are the ways to do really fast table lookup? One way is, one pretty fast way is you have the table sorted. Right? The table sorted, you go through, you see where in the table it is, oh, we got here stuff, and then you find it. You do a binary search of the table. Is the binary search of the table fast enough for what we want to do? Definitely not. What's faster than a binary search of the table?
What's a data structure that let me do table lookup? Well, actually, sorry. It's not table lookup. Well, it is table lookup, but it's really a key value mapping. The key is the virtual address. The value is the physical address.
I want to do a really fast key value lookup. What's the data structure used for that? Hash table, yeah. Hash map. Constant time. A hash table is not fast enough for this. Not nearly fast enough.
So instead of that, I'll tell you the fastest way to do a key value resolution is called a content addressable memory.
Content addressable memory is actually kind of how our brains work. When you want to find something in the memory of a regular computer, how do you find it? What do you find? You want to access RAM. What's your way of accessing RAM? It's by the address. RAM is
address accessible. You look at the address and it's okay, I want whatever the value is at location 2000. Get that value. Do you find anything out about anything else in memory? No. You just find out that particular thing. But a TLB instead has all these entries. Each of these is a page table entry in effect. This thing here gets it checks all of the page table entries at once in parallel to see which of them matches the virtual address. And it grabs it. Can you do this in software? Oh, heck no. This requires specialized circuits. Well, that's why I say when a content addressable memory, you stick this virtual address in and any of these that matches fires up. Now, in practice, does it actually map to a virtual address? Does it check all of them? No, but it checks a very large fraction, like 256,512 different entries it will potentially check at once before it finds out the mapping. Now, it'll tell you, yes, the mapping is there, or no, the mapping is. That should be a little crazy. So, like, wow, that's a complicated thing. How does it do that? Why don't we use it all the time? That's expensive to build. And it's expensive.
It is expensive, but that's because we need this to happen really fast, because this is the thing slowing down every memory access of the CPU. Even for going to the cache, it has to first figure out what the virtual to physical address, otherwise, what does it know? So,
We'll talk more about TLBs later, but that's the basic idea of TLB. Have a good weekend.
Oh, sorry. Have a happy Thanksgiving.